And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Each week, Ray spotlights in-depth interviews with legendary and up-and-coming authors and music artists. Ray also features the movers and the shakers of the music and publishing industries and suggests important methods for getting the most out of your public relations and marketing needs. Please welcome music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ray Shasho, broadcasting from BBS Radio, and welcome to the show where we spotlight legendary and up-and-coming music artists and authors, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or visit www.publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Bride of Chaotica's new 14-song CD serves as a tribute to over a half century of television broadcasting, an array of exotic instrumental tracks ranging from the eerie elegance of the Pink Floyd meets Happy the Man incandescents of Tom Morey to the intense firestorm impact of Pagan Jeopardy to the futuristic rendition of the 60s top 40 folk rock classic California Dreamin'. Additionally, the band's live studio recording philosophy is embellished here with additional brass, woodwinds, keyboards, and strings on many of the tracks, creating a whole new listening experience for the trio's longtime fans and supporters. With the band's new emphasis on their classic British psychedelic rock leanings and deployment of the concise background arrangements that were first displayed on last year's EP, Winter Tales, Bride of Chaotica's material is now shaded with instrumental drama only hinted at on their 2012 debut, Bamboo Transistor. The new tracks on Ghost on Television are 3D micro-movie soundtracks into themselves, and yet they still feature the trademark Bride of Chaotica analog live classic rock sonics that are the stock in trade for guitarist, keyboardist, arranger Bill Bechtel, bassist, synth bassist Robert Red Redman, and drummer, percussionist Tim Tuthill, who have been performing at festivals, clubs, art galleries, city parks, and video facilities on Florida's West Coast since 2009. Taking their name from a classic Star Trek Voyager episode, the group's debut CD received rave reviews in international publications like Progressive Magazine, 10 Pages and Big, Takeover Magazine, and tracks from both the band's debut and subsequent EP, Winter Tales, were featured on college and independent radio stations across the country and on National Public Radio's syndicated show, Undercurrents. Bride of Chaotica's new CD, Ghosts on Television, released on January 14, 2017 by Longview Records. The release coincides with the 50th anniversary of the first human being gathering of the new counterculture tribes in the San Francisco area at Golden Gate Park that drew an audience of 20,000 people and featured speakers such as Timothy Leary and Allen Ginsberg, and music by the Grateful Dead, the Jefferson Airplane, and other bands of the psychedelic era. Bride of Chaotica's latest CD, Ghosts on Television, is available from CD Baby, iTunes, through CD Baby, Amazon, and Google Play. Influences of Bride of Chaotica's arrangements are influenced by late 50s, early 60s, cool jazz era artists Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Wes Montgomery, 70s fusion groups Return to Forever, the Mahavishnu Orchestra and British Psychedelia, Jimi Hendrix, Cream, and Pink Floyd. Please welcome today guitarist, keyboardist, and arranger for the band Bride of Chaotica, Bill Bechtel, to the Ray Shasho Show. Thanks for being here, Bill.
Hey, well, thanks for having me, Ray. It's a great honor. It really is.
Let's see. Did you grow up in the Tampa area?
No. I'm an exile from Northeast Ohio. Actually, I grew up in the Warren Youngstown Steel District back in the day, so that's where I originally hail from.
Okay, from the Ohio area. When did you move over to Tampa or to Florida?
I ended up in Tampa circa late 1982. It was winter of 82, I think, I ended up in Tampa. I vividly recall that because I spent a day or two living in my van in between places to stay. So that's where I came up with the idea for the record company. I thought, I'm going to start my own record company, damn it, if I survive.
Yeah, exactly. Very last words of every musician, you know?
Right.
Living in a van by the river, right?
Well, it was kind of a way. It was actually in a gas station parking lot, but not too far from the river.
So you went to high school in Ohio?
Yes.
Did you start a band in high school? Is that where it all started, or was it, when did you first into music?
Yeah, that was it. And, you know, when I started playing, you know, back then the music scene was completely different. And, you know, there were a lot of people, you know, of my age who were, forming bands. And I was fortunate because we had the nice basement, you know, up there. And in the one room, it just ended up having a perfect acoustic. It was totally accidental, but the way my grandfather had built the bookshelf and the acoustic tile and everything, we got great sonics in there. So we would rehearse, you know, in the afternoons when, you know, mom was at work and stuff. And so it worked out really well. So I had a whole bunch of cover bands, you know, going through high school and into college. It wasn't until I got into college that I became serious about writing my own material and hence getting into the studio and recording. So that was a later development. But, you know, when I was 14, I had the whole thing figured out. It was like I bought me a Fender Stratocaster for $150, and then I thought,
oh, wow.
This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to turn pro. I'm going to end up writing and recording my own riffage and playing it out live. That was my goal. That was it right there. You know, I didn't want to be in a cover band. I didn't want to be a teacher or anything. I just wanted to go out, write and record my gear, and go out and play it. That was my big revelation at age 14 there. So.
And you're still doing it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like one of my old guitar techs, and he says, and it's been downhill ever since. So thanks, guy. You're real funny.
Yeah, exactly. So you got a trio. I don't know if you can call it a power trio, because you guys are into so much other kinds of music. Like, you know, you guys remind me a little bit of Mahavishnu, because you got that fusion going on, but then you got that psychedelia, imprint in the band, and so much other. You know, jazz is in there. I mean, it's a very tight band. It really is. What got you involved in that kind of music? And again, it's all instrumental and no singer. So what was the spark that wanted you to get, you know, do this?
Originally, this was our bass player Red's project. He invited me to join the band. This is not a recording project that I did. I usually form my own recording projects, but I was actually invited to join this one as the writer, arranger, guitarist. You know, so. So we put that together, and he had a definite fusion thing in mind from the get-go. There was never anything about having vocals or, you know, trying to go pop with it or anything. I mean, we started out very much influenced by the early 60s cool jazz stuff, specifically John Coltrane, you know, during that Village Vanguard era, you know, the Impressions album. That was always a big favorite of mine anyway. We kind of wanted to do the rock version of that. And we actually used to go out in the gigs dressed up in, like, suits of the time, period correct suits, you know, with the ties and everything. Well, except for a drummer, he never really got with the early 60s jazz wardrobe program there. So, you know, he would, you know, show up somewhat as the raised derelict, you know. But we at the front there, we had that suit and tie thing going on and everything. So it's very unusual, I think, for some of the audiences at the festival and stuff looking at it. I don't know if they quite knew what to think of us or where we were coming from. But that's how we started anyway, and so we've been together a long time, and it's sort of mutated over time, as one would expect.
Yeah, I got one of those promo pictures of you guys all dressed up, and I've got it on the BBS radio site, because it's pretty cool, actually. It looked like an album cover, you know, you guys all slicked up and everything.
Yeah, so, we took our wardrobe very serious back in those days, as somebody once commented.
You know who an artist that's very dapper and has always been very dapper? He doesn't care what the rest of the band looks like. Is Rick Derringer? He's always dressed differently than the rest of the band. The rest of the band might be in jeans and everything, and he's out there, and he still dresses that way.
Yeah, he's always had a good look. I always remember his look in that one album that he did, one of his first solo albums. He had this like silver suit with a matching glove, and he had this
right.
He was gripping. I said, "That's so cool, dude."
I know. It's not very often you see that. I think the trend now, as these music legends get older, it's all black. You know, you always see the black T-shirt. You know, you see David Gilmour wearing a black T-shirt. You know, you see. I guess that's the artist message is black. You know, and I do the same thing. I like wearing a black T-shirt for some reason.
Yeah, that goes back to that whole beat era thing. You know,
right.
Originally spawned that proto goth look, you know, and it's just carried on ever since.
Now, when did you start playing? Are you musically trained? Do you read music?
Oh yeah. When I was in grade school, I actually sang in the school choir. They didn't really have an instrument, but I sang chorus for a good many years until my voice changed.
Okay.
And that made me self-conscious about the voice. But that's when I started to take up guitar. A couple of years later, I'd been just banging around on this acoustic that my grandfather got me, but. You know, the kids up the street, they could play Three Dog Night songs and stuff by America, and so they were accomplished acoustic players, and that really wasn't my thing, you know, but when I got the electric guitar and I heard the Jimi Hendrix riffage at Woodstock, I thought, okay, this is something that I'd like to do, you know, and so, and, but then I went to music school, actually. It was totally insane at the time, and I signed on for a music major. It's a classical guitar major. That was my major, and I studied all kinds of other instruments, you know, like keyboards and brass methods and, you know, woodwinds. I mean, I was, you know, it was a very strict formalist classical school where I was at, you know. I really should have been out, like, in the West Coast at Guitar Institute of Technology or some recording school or something, you know, and, you know, studying the fusion jazz and stuff, recording whatnot.
Right.
But where I was, this was the best school, and so, and, you know, I could be there in, like, 20 minutes. And so it worked out. And it would probably make a pretty good TV show, actually, if you put some of the real-life events, you know, me coming, you know, in at 8 o'clock in the morning, you know, after some godforsaken gig out for the bikers out in the middle of nowhere, you know, and then come in and try and do these little piano exercises. I'd never studied piano in my whole life, see, and so I had to play these little exercises to get through theory. And so it was a real challenge, you know, being the rock and roll guitar heathen, you know, coming into a classical scene like that every day.
Well, a lot of the great prog artists, you know, are that way. They come from a classical background, and they get into, you know, the classic, you know, progressive rock genre. You know, it's a big help, actually. You know, I mean, if it wasn't for them being, you know, musically trained, we probably wouldn't have prog rock, you know?
No, it's a direct offshoot of that, you know. I mean,
it
very much seems to have sprung up from, you know, the impact of Sergeant Pepper, you know, and
right,
and you know, Sergeant Pepper, of course, was very much George Martin's baby. I'm thinking so. He was very much the exquisite classical arranger, but he, you know, he did it nice and simply. You know, John Barry, all those English guys have a very simple, direct style of arranging, and he utilized that to just excellent results on that later Beatles stuff. It was just great. And so, and then the prog guys, like the King Crimson comes out, you know, and it's like a completely different way of looking at the band thing. Genesis and all those guys were coming around back then. Pink Floyd had already gotten their leap out, you know. So, yeah, so the whole thing was just revving up for the prog rock thing. And I was very much, you know, involved in that, you know, especially in college because, you know, the classical training, like you say, goes hand in hand with the prog rock tradition.
That's right.
That's when I discovered King Crimson. That's when I started listening to him laying life down on Broadway, you know, on a regular basis. And, you know, I discovered, you know, a lot more stuff by people like Eno and Eno Fripp collaborations. I got into a lot of the weird stuff, too. So that coupled with all the psychedelic, you know, research I'd done, you know,
yep.
As far as the old 60s riffage, you know, that sort of all ended up combining over time, you know.
Well, it's a great mixture. It's a great mixure in music, you know. I interviewed Billy Cobham, you remember the Spectrum album, talking to him about that, you know, and a lot of that was just them, you know, getting together and jamming, pretty much. There was nothing really put on paper for that.
Well, that's interesting to find that out, you know, because that was a very influential album. You know, Tommy Bolin, you know, made big waves with that. And,
yeah.
I've heard a story that actually that was the impetus for Jeff Beck to basically come out and do the Blow by Blow album. Once he hit
Spectrum,
he was totally inspired, I guess. And so that's how the story goes. And I thought, well, way to go, Tommy. You know? I mean,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, he was a great guitar player, you know. Left us too soon, of course.
Yeah, back in Ohio, there was a little subcult among the guitar players in our scene, and they were total Tommy Bolin fanatics, you know. They had all his albums and everything. And so I got exposed to that, you know, at an impressionable young age, because these guys were totally into his playing, totally into his trip.
Yeah, I saw him. I actually saw him play twice. He played with the James Gang, and, you know, because Joe Walsh wasn't there at the time, and he played with Deep Purple. So I was lucky enough to see him.
He went and replaced two of my favorite players in Ohio. Joe Walsh, when I was coming up, he was like one of the godhead guitar players because he had, you know, got the national contract and everything. So it was him and Phil Kagi. Those guys were on the upper echelon there, you know. And so that was the bar that you had to meet. And Richie Blackmore was the big influence on me when I was, you know, starting to get good at playing in the solo and stuff. I was totally into the Deep Purple thing, and I just loved his whole style and his approach and everything. So Tommy went and replaced both those guys in the respective band. So I thought, yeah, way to go, Tommy.
Yeah, exactly. It's amazing. Yeah. Who were some of the – what school did you go to, college? And was that in Ohio also?
Yeah, it was at Youngstown State University. They had this whole division. It was called the Dana School of Music. They had a brand-new building. They had just built it circa 1976 or something, this modern architecture and all. They had all these like little, you know, like practice rooms, and they all had Steinway pianos in there. Everything was brand new, you know. And so that's where I went to school, because it had been founded back in like in 1869 or something back in my hometown, and the guy had eventually moved it to Youngstown. It got absorbed by Youngstown State or whatever, and here it was still perking along over 100 years later. So that's where I went to school.
You must have saw some good shows in Ohio, because that's one of the main hubs that shows come to, you know.
Yeah, we used to go to Cleveland all the time to see shows.
Right.
The best show of my life I've ever seen, bar none, was the Pink Floyd Animals Tour.
Yeah.
Yeah, this would have been circa 77 or so. We saw them at the Cleveland Stadium, and I've never seen anything like it before or since, I got to tell you. I've seen Pink Floyd again after that, but this show was just the penultimate experience, because not only did they play Animals in its entirety, which was like, you know, one of my favorite albums at the time. I was pretty much into that. I played the 8-track tape in our car all the time while we were cruising, you know. So that was constant background music. But they also played Wish You Were Here. They played most of Dark Side of the Moon, you know, and stuff from Mama Gumma and whatnot, you know. Metal, they did Echoes. I mean, so that was a good time to see them, man, because they did all the great stuff. It's so cool.
Yeah, they put on a show, a real show, you know. And
not
just a bunch of guys standing up on stage with their back turned towards the audience, you know. They put on a perfect show. And they sound great live, you know, which is not – I can't say that about a lot of the bands that I've seen in concert. You know, one band I was disappointed was the Rolling Stones. I had front row seats to see them. It was – during the album, they had Angie out at the time, Goat's Head Soup, I guess, and they didn't play very well. I was very, very disappointed. As a matter of fact, the opening band was the Mighty Clouds of Joy, a gospel band, and it actually sounded better than the Stones. I guess it wasn't their night.
No, that's not the first time that's happened. I've heard a reliable eyewitness report that one time the same thing happened when they played in Detroit with Santana. Santana just
blew
them
away. Yeah, I
and
know.
And then they come out, and I guess they were just playing one song over and over for like 20 minutes, and everybody's like, okay, we've had enough.
That's why they don't have a lot of, you know, big acts open for them, I think. You know, they're kind of afraid they get blown away.
I only saw them once. I saw them in New Orleans when they were on the Tattoo U tour. And,
right.
George Thorogood opened.
Oh, opened up? Not really.
So that was interesting. But they played sharp that night. I was lucky I saw that concert. You know, my brother-in-law, you know, we drove myself, my sister, and one of our friends, we drove all the way to New Orleans from Tallahassee to go see the show.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, so it was just a real expedition, you know. And
for
me, you know, New Orleans was so weird because, you know, it's just not the sort of place to be when you have absolutely no money, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
Hassle you. I mean, this was in the early 80s, you know. I could only imagine what it would be like now, you know. But anyway, so we went there, and but they did play sharp. They were good. They played well. I enjoyed that show. So it was worth the effort in the long run.
That's good. Brian Chaotica, I want to tell the audience here, is the 106th episode of the American science fiction television series Star Trek Voyager. This is where you got the name. The episode largely takes place on the holodeck, which is running a holo program in black and white instead of the usual color. The episode contains many elements of the classic 1936 film serial Flash Gordon. In the episode, Voyager becomes stuck on an interdimensional rift as photonic beings from the other dimension attempt contact in the holodeck, meaning the photonic villains of Lieutenant Paris, Captain Proton program, who promptly attack them. So is that where you got this?
Yeah, no, I did that. And I remember it was like, we put the band together, and I had some songs written for it to play and stuff. I mean, we had material and stuff, but no one knew what to call it. Red didn't have any ideas, you know. So I had the full piece of paper, and I wrote Brian Chaotic on it, because I remember I watched that episode on TV. I would have the TV on when I was working on stuff, you know, back in my old house in Sherwood there. And so that episode came on, and I was just like totally taken with the whole concept of this thing, you know. It was a great episode for these guys.
Yeah.
I thought, Pride of Chaotica. It was like, dang, hey, here's a cool band name. So I have a rule with cool band names that I keep over the years, so that one went on there. So I pulled that one out for this occasion. And you should just see the look of just, it was just stunned silence. They looked at this, and it's just like, okay, this is not going to go over. But after a while, they warmed up to it, and so we had decided to run with that name, you know. And it's a great name because, you know, if you're doing your own stuff, you want to stand out. You just don't want to have a regular name or a silly name, you know, like a round jack or something, you know. You want something to stand out. So it really, really works. And if you have a name that works for your band, like, you know, that saves you so much mileage. Like, you know, Jerry Garcia, the Grateful Dead, man. That,
yeah,
name alone,
exactly.
That opened so many doors for those guys, I'm sure, you know. Especially at the time. So, well, anyway, we had the cool name, you know. But since we were sort of like playing this proto, you know, retro cool jazz kind of rock psychedelic fusion stuff, you know, and we're playing in these city gigs and stuff, and they were thinking we're some sort of like black metal band or something, you know. They're expecting heavy metal or something. I'm going, it's like they're scared of the name, and so we had to deal with that early on, and some of the, especially dealing with like some of the city and county people, you know, because they just started freaking about that, you know. And I'm going, it couldn't be further from the truth, you know.
Well, you won the hearts of all sci-fi fans, that's for sure.
That's it. You know, we had some Trekkie get on there late last year. We got something on the Facebook page, and he's like, best name ever, all capital letters, with all these exclamation points here. I was like, okay, see, now there's a guy who's paying attention.
Yeah, if you can win over Trekkies, you got it made.
Hey, I'd love to do one of the Star Trek convention deals, man. I mean, if they had us play one of those deals, I would travel across the country to do that.
Cool.
You know?
That would be awesome. I'm a Trekkie. I lean more towards the original series, but I've actually seen Gene Roddenberry do a conference. I mean, it was 20,000 people there, and he showed all the bloopers and, you know, from the show and all kinds of stuff. I thought that was pretty cool to see Gene Roddenberry in person.
No, I would love to meet that guy in person when he was alive. I mean, because I was so into Star Trek. I watched the very first episode when I was a kid, and I knew it was happening. See, I found out about the show, and I was waiting for it, you know. I mean, I was so into it. And I watched as many of those shows as I could, you know, during the first run. And it just had this profound effect on me, you know. I mean, I guess, you know, some people who didn't get into Star Trek were like, oh, here's all the sci-fi freaks, and they're going off in Trekkie Land or whatever.
Yeah. It's amazing how many things came true from the original series, you know?
Yeah, you know, when the cell phone thing came out, I got one with the flip-top things right away because of the communicator thing, right?
Yeah.
And I still have it now, you know, that's what we're talking on. I'm not doing the smartphone thing. I'll have to bump up to the tricorder eventually, I suppose.
Right now, the tricorder.
Right now, I'm still using the communicator deal.
I want to talk about the new release, Ghost on Television. First of all, I really enjoyed the CD. My quote is, I call it a brilliant orchestrated array of progressive fusion and psychedelic moods and swings, and I gave it 5 stars. I thought it was, you know, anybody that wants to kind of chill out, put this CD on their in their car, and just, I mean, if they put this CD in their car, they're gonna end up in California. If they're, you know, you're gonna just, you know, space out, man. But it's a great CD. Some of my favorite track was The Science of Rust. I really enjoy that track the most. And I had a few other favorites as well. But you also did a couple of covers, right? There was two covers, California Dreamin' and While My Guitar Gently Weeps. Is that right? Just the two covers?
Right, yeah. We had two covers on the first album too, so I guess this is our little pattern, our trend that we do. We do two covers. We always end with a Beatles song. So. The first album,
you had a great jam at the end of that, by the way. While My Guitar Gently Weeps, I like the jam at the end there.
Yeah, the concept of that was like if Clapton was busy that day, what if they had Jimi Hendrix come in and do the solo instead, you know? So I was kind of going for that. And at the end, well, of course, it mutates after that. So then at the end, I was thinking of the Mick Ronson thing where he's like playing Moon Age Daydream, you know, and he's got that endlessly echoing through the Echoplex guitar thing. I always thought that was so cool, you know? So that starts creeping in after the wah-wah guitar solo bit, you know? So I was like, okay, all the Sonics are here now.
Yeah. You know what I like about you, not only your music, but you know your music, you know, which is, it's hard to talk to anybody about, you know, the full scope of rock, prog, and psychedelia today. It's hard to find anybody to talk with. It really is.
I
talk to the music legends all the time, you know, they know their stuff, of course, but, you know, it's really hard to find people to talk, you know, about the old days and, you know, things like that. I'm tired of hearing about Taylor Swift.
Oh, God, no. I can't help you there, son. Well, you know, I was always a fan, you know. I mean, I loved the bands, you know. We couldn't go to the shows when I was a kid, but I would get all the records and stuff. And, you know, back then we didn't have videos and stuff, but you could watch shows like Don Kirshner's Rock Concert or In Concert. And you could see bands like Roxy Music playing live, you know. Genesis came out and did Watcher of the Skies on the Midnight Star. It's one of the most bizarre things you could ever hope to see. They didn't even have the Mellotron or anything. They flew them in and Studio Instrument Rental in L.A. gave them a bunch of gear to use, and so they had to make do. But it's brilliant, man. It was just fabulous to see this thing. Gabriel had his space costume thing on and everything.
Yeah.
It was classic. Oh, God. I used to watch stuff like that. You know?
I just talked to Frank Marino, who was on Don Kirshner, and he was on the Midnight Special, and he did Cal Jam 2. He wasn't a big fan of Cal Jam 2 because he thought it was...
I didn't know they had two of them. I remember the first one. I watched that one when it came out, you know, on TV, you know, but...
Yeah,
I know. God, Black Sabbath kicked ass, and they had ELP was the headline on that, as I recall. Yeah, that was crazy seeing the spinning piano deal.
That leaves a big impression on you,
even to this day. I still vividly recall seeing that stuff.
Yeah, I actually talked to Keith Emerson about the spinning piano for a long time. He was a good guy. If you go to Wikipedia under Keith Emerson, you'll see the excerpt about me and him talking about the spinning piano. It's really interesting.
Oh, yeah, that's totally cool.
Yeah. Science of Rust, Splendor in the Grass. Talk about the Night of the Living Swing Zombies. Talk about making that one.
Oh, yeah, that one's classic. it was kind of a departure. We've been kind of leaning more into the psychedelic, the British psychedelic rock thing, you know, as far as our stylistic motifs, as it were. But, you know, the J word, it keeps creeping back in, you know. And so it was a jazz piece. And so I thought, you know, we were doing the horns and stuff. And I said, I'm just going to make this into like a kind of a mutant cool jazz kind of thing, you know. And then we'll have this cool, you know, like Santana-esque jam thing at the end of it, you know, just to give it something different, you know. And just spice it up a bit, give it more of that modern fusion thing or whatever, you know. But it started mutating right away, so, you know, it was like, you know, it was a nice sort of really subtle early 60s kind of thing in the beginning, and I came up with that little lead guitar line on top of it, and I thought, this is almost very traditional-like, you know, and then we would have the horns come in, you know, for all the breaks. And I did that specifically with that 1959 cool jazz horn arrangement style. I wanted to capture that, you know, so I thought that came out really well. I was real happy with that, you know, because it does come through.
Were these real horns or were these, you know, electronic?
No, you know, there's no way I could afford a horn section. You know, these guys would play the horn. No, seriously, you get them in there, and they want like $150 for a song. And I'm like, dude, man, there's five of you, you know. That's my whole album budget right there, you know.
Yeah, I
mean,
yeah, I know.
Yeah, we record on the cheap, kid, believe me. So, you know, and it's, I was like, okay, so what we're going to do here is I got to find my, I have this Insonic Mirage, and that's like been my studio partner in crime for decades now, but it doesn't have good horn samples. It's like state-of-the-art 1985, and it just doesn't do the horn thing very well, except for maybe the French horns on a good day. But then I found this Casio at the studio where we were at. It was like this, it was a newer model, but they don't make them anymore. It's a WTK something or other. And I turned it on, and I was expecting really cheesy horns, you know. Lo and behold, the things sound like the real thing. I was like, holy, I can't believe it, man. So I was like, we're going to take this, and we're going to use it for all the horn sections on the album, you know. And that enabled me to do this album. If it hadn't been for that keyboard, I wouldn't have been able to pull off those horn arrangements. Because, you know, they really do, you know, conjure up the sound. It's the real thing, you know. And this is something that I could do, you know. I could arrange these. I could play them. And I went and recorded them like that. I just didn't do the block chords. I sat there and recorded each little instrument like, you know, okay, here's the trumpet guy. He's doing his part. We would record that. And then and I always run my keyboards through an amp here, you know, because you can get much better sonics with the digital stuff, especially if you just run it through an amp. I remember this New York rockabilly guitar player guy hit me to that concept. And so I've been doing that ever since. And it works beautifully, you know, and it just, like, gives you this really, you know, like, expansive tone that you normally don't get when you're just running through the computers all the time, you know. So, yeah, so that just worked out really cool. And then, well, of course, once it starts into that, you know, that 6/8 jam stuff or whatever, and that's where it got really weird, because then it all of a sudden I'm going back to the early Hendrix, like, Are You Experienced thing. And I thought, oh, well, Let's put the feedback solo from Third Stone in. And I was like, oh, Red couldn't believe it. The first time he heard that, he completely freaked. He thought I was going to do some fusion-esque solo or something during all that, right? But, or, you know, at least some, you know, you could be traditional and just do the Santana rock thing, you know, play along in those sort of modes. But no, this was completely out of left field and left the ballpark altogether, and you got all this roaring feedback, you know. And this is completely out of character for me as well, because, you know, I'm trying to get the Epiphone scholarship with this band, right? I just use Epiphone guitars for the most part, you know. And so this was the Fender Stratocaster making its first appearance on the Bride of Chaotica album, so I thought it was noteworthy just for that, because I had to have something that, you know, I could do the extreme Wang Bar stuff with, you know, and so there you go, man. I just pulled out this, I actually have a Hendrix Strat that I made. I took this left-handed Squire decades ago, and I turned it around so I could play it right-handed, so it's upside down, just like Hendrix's.
Yeah.
And like, so I set it all up, you know, strings reversed and everything, and that's the one I used for the song there, because I got that left-handed tremolo thing going on. And it's like, and I can tell you, honest to God, Hendrix played the way he did in spite of his guitar setup, not because of it.
it's amazing, though, the setups that are going on nowadays. You know, when you, you know, watch a guitar player and you look on the floor and you see all these pedals and, you know, fuzz busters and all kinds of stuff. You know, it's really, you know, I mean, the technology is amazing. You know, and a lot of these guys just make their own stuff, you know.
Yeah, there's a whole, like, boutique pedal industry that's come up now in the last, like, 10, 15 years or so. I mean, it was around back in the early 90s, but now it seems to have exploded. Everybody and his brother's pet Salamander is making, you know, boutique boxes that you can buy, overdrives, delays, choruses, and they're pricey, too. They only start at, like, $199. I'm like, God, well, God bless them. There's one even back in Ohio, in Akron, you know. I thought, well, next time I'm up there, I should swing by the Earthquake or something like that. But anyway, you know, yeah, there's all kinds of these guys in garages, and they're making their own pedals and stuff. It's like the golden age of pedals and microphones. You can buy great microphones now for really good prices, and so this is the golden era for guitar pedals and studio microphones, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, and you don't even need a studio anymore.
Well, yeah, that's the problem. Most of my peers who actually worked in commercial studios, I mean, turns snot around, and I don't think there's enough to keep him going, you know. And
yeah,
you know, like even the big guys in Tampa, you know, were around for decades. They've closed up shop, you know.
Yep.
And they have smaller studios, or else they work as project studios that somebody else owns, and they let them come in and do their work. That's what the Morris Brothers are doing. You know, they're working out of a studio in South Tampa now that some millionaire guy built, you know, in back of the house or whatever. So they go down there, and you know, because well, it's already there. They don't have to build a new building in Ybor and deal with all the, you know, the weird permitting and God knows what, and not to mention spending at least $150K or $200K. You're gonna, you know, to do the room proppers and everything to get the whole thing set up with proper cabling and everything. You can drop a lot of lottery money on a studio in no time, you know, believe me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, you play, besides keyboards, do you play Moog synthesizer or Mellotron?
I have a Mellotron. I built a couple of digital trons, you know.
You have a Mellotron. Oh, wow.
Yeah. I've got number 809. She's her name's Daphne. And I'm thinking her vintage is about 1973, which pretty much puts her sonically around the era of like the King Crimson, Larks Tongue and Aspect kind of Mellotron sonics. That's, if you listen to that album, mine sounds a lot like that, you know, especially with the strings. And I've got these strings, flutes, and cello tapes in mind. They're original tapes, I'm thinking, because I never changed them. They came from this guy who had it in Austin, so he shipped it to me, and it looks like the original deal. So this one's pretty much in the same kind of condition it was when she rolled off the assembly line. I haven't, you know, done any of the mods or put any outrageous new parts in. Like I say, if I got the money, I would like to do the restoration, but I'd say no, don't put the new motor system in or anything. I want to keep the old motor, you know, the warbling out of tune bit. I want to keep it as is.
Right.
Like, just make it like new 1973, you know. That's what I would do if I had the money, you know. But long before that happens, I'll probably be getting one of those ultra cool digital Mellotron minis that Marcus Resch is making over there in Switzerland. They're little digital trons, and he didn't quit until he had one that would pretty much go side by side with one of the old 400s, and in a blindfold test, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. And so that's what he's got there, and so that's what I'm going to buy. And it's nice because the little ones, you can get those for like $2,000 or less. So the little rack deal goes for $1,500. So that's almost affordable. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the other guys in the band. Where did you guys meet, and what are their backgrounds?
Red, the bass player, Red and I have been working together on studio work and in bands for like 20 years. We had this one band back in the day called Dimension X that I put together. And Dimension X was sort of like the big bang of all the Longview Records projects. I mean, we played everything in that band. It was really, had overarching ambition, far beyond the flexibilities, I might add, including my own. But we played surf. We did we had like a sort of alternative folk stuff. We did sci-fi rock, you know. So we had a bunch of different things going on, and each one of these aspects, you know, would end up being something that would end up being its own project stylistically later on. So, but that's where we first met, and we've been doing studio work, you know, and playing in different projects together ever since.
Right.
He played on my surf album, The Hydrotones. He was a bass player for that. He also played on my alternative folk rock album that came out in 2004 called The Zachary Jones Band. He did a great job with that. He also played on the first My Wild Heaven, the sci-fi rock debut that we did back in 2008. He played bass on that as well. He's got some really stellar riffage on that one. So, yeah, that's a good one to get if you're looking to high-tech Red playing. That's the one to have right there. And so we've been working together for all this time. Jim, he used to play with this band back in the day that my old engineer was touring with as a sound man. And they did this college rock thing back in the day. This booking agency would book him to play in colleges. And so he did a short tour with them. And then later he hooked up with Red, and they had this band. It was more of a project kind of thing called Low Frequency Shaman. It was kind of like a jam thing, but a little bit more of a progressive thing. A lot of improvised material live, you know. So, and it always had a kind of a revolving sort of lineup. And so he carried that on for a few years. He played in some big halls, too. He played at the State Theater in downtown St. Petersburg and stuff. So, you know, they did real well for themselves as far as getting cool gigs and stuff. But, you know, that after he did that, he just wanted to have something, you you know, that wasn't as big, because it was a big band. He had, like, you know, 5 or 6 people always playing this stuff. He just wanted a simpler band, and he wanted to have regular, you know, regular songs, material that you could play, rather than going up and, you know, hoping that, you know, that you would just magically be able to conjure up some cohesive riffage on a regular basis, you know, with players who'd never even jammed with you before. You know, it's real iffy, you know, so sometimes it works, and sometimes, well, maybe not, so... But this was a different way to go with, and get that instrumental thing that he wanted to do, but in a lot more controllable and probably acceptable package too, you know. So
right.
So we all got together.
Yep. Now you guys got this great new CD out. Okay. Are you going to be touring in support of the CD here pretty soon, or what do you got planned?
Well, we really don't venture out too far, you know, for, you know, just all kinds of logistics and the fact that, you know, we really don't even have the money to buy a vehicle anymore. It's not like back in the 80s when I did the touring thing. You know, back then, right, we were banging around the back of vans living on bottled water and crackers. But, you know, you could go and play gigs and you'd make, like, you know, $250 to $500 a night for one
right.
set. And back then, that'd be like making $1,500 a night. Now, probably, was
yeah.
if you did the exchange rate, the inflation adjustments and whatnot. So now you don't make anything near that kind of money, and of course gas has, like, gone up to the point, and even worse, like, hotel rooms. Like, our big thing was to do 24-hour jaunts. We could drive to some godforsaken place here in Florida and then drive back the same night, so we wouldn't have to pay for the hotel room, because we were just cheap back then, you know. But now you have to, because they're $100 a night. I routinely recall driving to Ohio back in the early 90s, and you could stop in any town along the way and get in a Econo Lodge room for like 20, maybe 25 bucks, man.
Right.
Those days are gone, man. Touring is like a nightmare unless you're well off, you know. And God only knows what you're going to make at the door in some of these clubs that you poke yourself into. So, yeah, it'd be a real survival trip, you know. So
yeah,
what
you know,
we do is we pick an area within a 75-mile radius, and we're just
right.
start concentrating on that before we start branching out. Once you get established somewhere, then you can go touring and stuff, you know. And I remember one booking agent in New York, I read an interview with him, he says, if you can't get 100 people to come to your shows locally, then you shouldn't be touring yet. You should be working on the locals first. You know, so he says, unless you live out in the middle of nowhere in Nebraska somewhere, you know, you need to work on your own crowd, you know. So we're taking that advice to heart because, you know, Tampa Bay Area is a big metro market for music. I mean, and we're venturing over to Orlando now. We're playing in this microbrewery called the Dead Lizard Cafe up in Orlando.
Yeah, I saw that.
Basis.
Yep.
And so, you know, I think our niche right now is we're going to try to infiltrate the microbrewery mm-hmm. sort of venues and try to make a little... you know, carve out a little niche for ourselves there, and then we can, you know, then you can expand from that, you know. I figure at that point, you know, we can just, you know, we can buy us, you know, some decent van or transportation. Maybe we can venture out and go up further north and maybe get into Atlanta or something along the way. Or better yet, if someone in Europe wanted to go play for a week, you know, and it's going to, you know, help us with the, you know, gear and expenses and whatnot, you know, accommodations, you know, yeah, we would go if someone would roll out the carpet, you know. And that's something I could do for a week, you know. I wouldn't want to do the old-fashioned thing of, like, you know, okay, you're on the road 275 days a year, because then you don't get anything done, you know. I mean, I've got all these projects and all these recordings and things to do, and if, I say, if I had the budget, man, I'd be in the studio every day, you know. I wouldn't be coming out until late at night, you know, if at all. So, and this way it's better because we get to pick and choose our gigs and how far we're going to go, and then we can just sort of try and build up our audience, which we really need to do anyway. So it's always a good thing.
You've got a St. Paddy's gig coming up, don't you?
Yeah, that's a Lizard Cafe there. We're definitely doing that one. So I was looking to do some sort of St. Patrick's Day theme kind of thing. Or something. I'm not Irish, you know, and I'm not familiar with the music. I mean, I've had some, you know, exposure to Celtic stuff over the years and whatnot. In fact, that's what probably got us the gig, because we were playing it in between sets until the last show we did. So they're like, you guys can play it St. Patrick's Day. Okay, no problem. But so I wrote a little thing for us to do. You know, I listened to the song called The Whiskey Jar, and so I thought, okay, well, you know, this is the style. We can come up with something that's simpler and more direct and fits by the Chaotica. So I just wrote this whole thing about Ireland, so we're probably going to whip that one out on them and see how that goes. You know, sometimes we do that. We do the Pink Floyd Led Zeppelin thing. It's like, we try out the new material for the next album or whatever, an unsuspecting audience, and see how it goes. So I'm a firm believer of that, you know, because it's like
rubber. We've got a lot of good clubs here in the Sarasota area that'll be good for you.
Yeah, I'd like to get down there because that's somewhere we could drive. We could probably get there quicker than going to Orlando, I'm thinking. And, you know, Sarasota is just a cool place, man, because I remember going down there back in the day. We never really played clubs that much down there, but I would go visit and go to places down there, and they always had the most beautiful beaches and stuff, and it just seemed like a cool atmosphere, you know, just a really nice arts-friendly kind of place in a way, you know, really tranquil and laid back like that. You know, I don't know if it's really like that, you know, to live there, but it just seemed that way to me when we were, you know, running through there.
You know, you need to check out the Blue Rooster. That's a cool place to play.
Blue Rooster, should write that down.
Yeah. They've got a lot of jazz sessions. You guys would fit right in, I think. It's not just a jazz club. They've got, you know, a little bit of everything.
That's in Sarasota proper, then?
Yep.
Okay, cool.
It's called Blue Rooster.
Yeah, I'm writing that one down. I'm making a list. You know, I'm helping Red do the booking now. So I try to find a place every week to try and hit up and see if we can get in, you know.
Does Red do all the booking for you?
Well, technically that's his job, but he's needed
help
with it, you know, because, he had his work cut out for him. It's hard to book instrumental rock down here anyway. That's why I never formed a surf band with the Hydrotones album, because A, I couldn't afford the horn players, and B, there was nowhere to play. You know, you might get a gig once every year or two, and that would be it. And so it's hard to book the instrumental thing, so it's an uphill climb, you know. And when you're playing original music to go with, well, that makes it even more difficult, so... But I've been helping him out. We have a classic rock band, the stuff that we do now. You know, we're not really going for that, you know, well-suited jazz thing anymore. We've kind of gone more into the psychedelic rock thing. We're playing a lot of the classic rock tunes that people dig, you know, the Beatles stuff and, you know, the 60s tunes. And, you know, we do everything from the 60s to the 80s. We're even doing rock and music tracks, you know. So it's just like, it's a little something that for everybody in there. And so people dig that, and then... That makes them more receptive to listening to our stuff, too. So you know, I've been helping them out. We've been kind of branching out. We work for the city of Tampa now. My licensed music vendor with them, I got signed on. So I've been bringing Bride of Chaotica over there. We play at the Curtis Nixon Park. We played down at the Gaslight Park downtown. You know, and so you know, we've been getting stuff like that and just trying to, you know, kind of expand the whole concept of this so that people can be introduced to the instrumental aspect of it, you know, and see that, you know, okay, yeah, they can do it. They don't need to have guys up there screaming songs out. Some guy in a leather jacket screaming! You know, none of that. You know, we can go see the band that you would watch, or we can actually kind of function as a background kind of music soundtrack kind of band, too. You know, we've done that before, you know, that we can just sort of play in the background, you know, and we're still doing what we do, but, you know, it's something I don't like a wedding reception or something, you know. We've actually done gigs like that, you know.
A lot of bands have made money just from video games, you know.
Well, that's an idea.
And
that's something I'm really working on now because, you know, like I say, my days of being the touring rock and roll star are probably, you know, like, you know, past due over. But something I can succeed at and actually would run with and would suit my endeavor would be to license things, you know, like to get on a soundtrack of a movie or else a recurring TV show scene, you know. Like, look at the Rembrandt guys. Say what you will about their only album that they had, you know, their songwriting. But these guys are billionaires. They could hobnob with Warren Gates and people like that. You know?
That's all they needed, one hit.
With a French song like that, boy, you know, they'd probably rake in, you know, like hundreds of thousands of dollars per week. You know? I mean, come on, it's in China, it's in Russia. They play it all over the world, you know. So that's what I need, see, something like that. And it could be a movie, like I said. I remember vividly talking to Carl Verheyen, you know, back when I used to work at this guitar instruction company. He came in to do one of his little courses, and he told me that he did the soundtrack for this film. He wondered if I ever heard of it. It was called Moscow and the Hudson with Robin Williams. I said, yeah, I'm familiar with it, you know. I think I have it on a VHS tape, actually. He says, well, you know, it was me and about three or four other guys in that soundtrack, and after it was done, we just split the proceeds. And I got to tell you, man, I just got a check for $20,000 for that gig. I was like, dude, see, that's all I need, man.
That's all it takes. That's all it takes,
I need one of these songs to be, you know, signed up like that, and I get recurring income so I can just, you know, go and do my studio thing, and that would pay for everything. And then, of course, like Ian says, with success, it breeds the opportunity for continued success. So once you get your foot in the door or something like that, I'm thinking other opportunities and offers will probably come down the road.
Yep.
And you could say, okay, well, you did this, so how about we could get something for you to do that? I said, yeah, sign me up, man.
Well, the other thing is you're such a, you know, a good guitar player and you're a multi-instrumentalist. You could do a lot of session work on albums.
That was my original goal. I mean, like I say, the alternative universe, the young Bill Bechtel did move to California and he did become a session guy. And you know, before the whole, you know, era of being a session guy and playing on rock albums was over, you know, he probably did okay for himself, you know.
Right.
But, you know, the problem I have with that now, though, is that even though I'd be adept at it, you know, and I generally do good in my collaborations with other folks, since I've got such a horrendous backlog of material now that I have to do that, you know, it's really problematic for me to go out and play with other people. Unless, of course, it was like some sort of thing where they'd say, okay, well, we need you to do a couple album tracks and we're going to pay you all this money to do it. And I'd say, okay, well, then, yeah, once again, that's like, see you previous letter A with the licensing deal. We'll get a bunch of cash and we can continue our gig. And it will only take me a few weeks to do this. Or these days, I could probably record it here in town if they just sent me the files. You know, I could just, I could just record down the road here at Groovehaven, and then we could send them the files, and then they could do their mixes and everything in New York or LA or wherever. So, you know, I could do that, you know. But as far as, you know, like, you know, going out of my way every so often and doing an album with someone, no, I really can't, because I don't get the chance to even work on my own stuff the way I want to. So I've got like 75 tracks now I have to record for the My Wild Heaven sci-fi rock project alone, you know. Bride of Chaotica has two albums of stuff that I'm working on to put out, you know. So, you know, like I say, just these two projects alone, I've got almost 100 songs to have to be, you know, recorded and, you know, mixed and mastered. So that's a lot of work, you know. So I'm just going to have to buckle down and try and knock this stuff out.
Have you ever thought about adding a singer to maybe a couple tracks just to see how it would play out?
No singing! That's always been my mantra. It's just like the little demons that were in Binkley's closet in Bloom County, you know. Tammy Faye would come up out of the closet, and she said, now we're going to sing a song. And all the little gremlins and demons would be there screaming, no singing! So that's what we do, man. Anybody, some drunken guy comes up and wants to take the mic, I say, no. No singing! We don't have any vocals ever.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I remember once T-Man and I, you know, had a spirited discussion about, you know, getting some famous, you know, I don't know, he always thinks in terms of some famous celebrity, but they're unnamed, so we don't know whose style he might be talking to. It's just a concept, you know, some, you know, like, like, dude, no, I'm not going to be working with some Taylor Swift or Beyonce just because they sell X amount of records, and we think we can hitch a ride and they're a star. It doesn't work like that, because once you do that, people are going to expect you to do that sound, what they heard, and then they're going to realize the ugly truth is that, well, Bride of Chaotic is this really weird mutant rock band that has nothing to do with this artist that we've, you know, written on the coattails of, no matter how much glitz is on there, how much money they might throw at us. You know, just like, you know, you've kind of derailed your progress. I'd rather make slow, steady progress and get to cult following and do that, you know? I mean, you know, like Jerry Garcia said, he was perfectly content with the Dead before they became mega superstars, because they had their own audience. They could go work on whatever they wanted to. They made enough to pay the crew and everything. It was a nice little symbiotic system they had there, you know. But once they had to hit songs, everything started going to hell in a handbasket, man.
Yeah, they were lucky because they got a following, a huge following.
That was back in the day. Like I say, it was a lot easier to tour back in the 70s than it is now. And they were really basically a working, well-known working band. That's what Garcia said in one of his interviews I read, you know. I was never much of a Deadhead, but I read every single Jerry Garcia interview and guitar player and stuff. So it's just like, I was like one of his pals. I could hang out with him, you know, if he ever came to play. We ended up in a guitar store, so we could hang out and talk about stuff, you know, even though we might have completely, you know, different styles and takes on the psychedelic music thing, you know. It's just like, We could sit and chat, you know, because we would have a lot in common. And he had so many cool perspectives and things, you know. And I find him inspiring. Even, like I say, I don't really have, you know, listen to a bunch of Dead stuff, but I find him inspiring just because of his notions. I wrote this one song, the My Wild Heaven project about Woodstock, because I read this interview, and this Woodstock of Rolling Stone, a commemorative from about 10 or 20 years back, and he's like, you know, he was saying, you could feel the presence of time travelers in the audience who came back to see Woodstock. I'm thinking, genius Brian Rithics, dude. That is brilliant. So I wrote the song from the perspective of the time travelers coming back to see Woodstock, you know. It's called
right.
Woodstock Notions, you know. So, yeah, but people can inspire you like that, you know, and it has nothing to do with music even. It's just their, you know, their perspective on things and their whole zeitgeist, as it were, you know.
Well, one thing I have to say, you still got to eat. I talked to Dennis LeCourrier of Dr. Hook, and after
yeah.
they did cover the Rolling Stone, they
I
went
remember
bankrupt.
When that came out.
They went bankrupt.
Really?
They
I
went
had no
bankrupt.
Idea.
They were trying to do their same thing and trying to do, you know, stick to their format, and they went bankrupt. So they had to do something, and that's when they start disco came out, and they started writing some kind of disco-ish kind of music, and they
really?
made a fortune.
Well, they did good for themselves there, see? A lot
they
of bands tried to switch the disco thing, and they fell flat on their faces because, of course, they really didn't have that thing. They
but imagine Dr. Hook going disco-ish, you know, with a guy with a patch and everything, and it worked. they made a lot of money.
Yeah, we'd never see them as the consummate disco band from the era. We just wouldn't, you know. I had no idea, you know.
But like you said, now going back to the old format, it's changed. You know, and the people aren't going to expect to see the you know the original Dr. Hook anymore. It's going to be more or less you know the pop songs that they're going to
yeah.
be playing in concert. So, yeah, I mean, it's either sell your soul or not sell your soul.
Well,
you know?
Look at it this way. At least they're doing their own disco songs and not somebody
right.
else's in some
exactly.
lounge band somewhere. I mean.
Right.
Like I said, I could never really see myself as you know, being in some note-for-note cover band kind of thing because that would just be the dearth of, you know, there's no creativity involved with that
oh,
at
no,
all.
Oh, no, there isn't. I agree with you. I mean,
yeah
what you guys are doing is great, you know. It's just
you know,
sometimes you have to, you know, you might have to go with the, I don't know, make a little more commercial maybe, I guess, or just do one hit. How's that?
Yeah, well, that's all I need.
Right,
see,
right
that's
one
all
hit.
I can run that. Hey, I do have a country song for someone. I can't do it. I can't do the country thing, but I wrote this really cool country song. Somebody
that's all
like
it takes.
Rolf, they could run with it. So all I got to do is make a demo of this thing and find
right.
some sort of channel in there, and I'll give them the song. Just keep. I'll keep my writer royalties, and you guys can run with this. I you know, don't be putting me in a cowboy hat or trying to do music videos on country TV now. I'm not doing that, but you guys can run with the song, and I'll just sit back and collect the checks. Thank you very
there you
much.
Go. There you go.
That's all I need. I don't mind. I don't mind being the author of a number one, you know. I mean, I'd put my stuff up there against anybody's, man. I mean, as far as you know, stuff coming out in Nashville today, I said, this song you guys could run with, man. It's really funny. The average working class hero guy can really totally relate, man. So,
well, that's where the money is. The money's in songwriting, you know. I mean, you're set for life. If you write a song and somebody makes it big with your song, you know, if you play a song, do a cover and make it big, it's nothing like had written a song.
That's why I told Red the danger of us doing songs like The Look of Love and stuff. If one of these
right.
damn things takes off, okay, yeah, we're recognized and we're notable, but the problem is back at home, young William's not making any money on fucking it's just like I'm not pulling in the cash. Nancy Sinatra is or someone, you know, or Brett Bacharach or somebody, you know. I mean, so I'm thinking, okay, what we need to do here is just make sure one of our songs gets to be the hit.
just make one hit. Make one hit so you can, you know, go on tour.
Well, you know, as soon as I get this stuff recorded, I figure then I can find proper channels. You know, I need to make a demo of my country song. I
right,
need to get
right.
some of my other projects recorded and get them out there. At the very
right.
least, I'll put them in the digital domain so people can check them out, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the one nice thing I like about working with CD Baby now. They're my de facto record company. I can put all my stuff up on their site. They do videos for me for free on YouTube. They just have cool little graphics that they do, and they put the whole album with songs. You can find each album and just it'll just automatically play all 12 or 8 songs or whatever you got on there. And see, that's perfect for me, you know, because eventually that will, you know, I could get, you know, the more people who check out what I'm doing, regardless of which project it is, this will help them introduce them to the other projects, and they can go on YouTube and check the albums out
right,
for free.
Exactly.
You know? And if a bunch of them start doing that, then guess what? Young Williams is making more checks because they're advertising there now, you know? It's like, I can take the ad money. I don't have problems raking the corporations over the coals for their cash, you know? I mean, it's me, damn it.
Well, I've got a few country connections, and, you know, it'd probably be worth you taking a trip to Nashville, too.
If someone wants to give me the good contract, yeah, I'll cruise up there. I've been in Nashville before, you know? So,
why not?
Yeah, so, it, you know, like I say, someone could run with this, and they would have the bona fide hit single. I mean, it just came to me, and it's, those are always the coolest and best songs, the ones that just come to you. You're not trying to sit there and write a hit song. No, that's the wrong approach. You just, you know, you just keep writing, you come up with stuff, and occasionally something will just come and visit you,
sure.
And then, boom, you've got the cool song that everybody's going to dig, you know. So you just got to get it out there so people can pick up on it and have the proper people doing it. Like I say, I'm not going to sit there and try and go up there and do the country thing. I'll give it to someone who can do it, you know.
Right.
And I'm thinking about hiring one of the guys who plays in the local Deadhead band here to do the vocals, because I think he could probably do a good job on it. I'll just make a simple little demo.
Let me know when you have that song out. Send it to me, and I'll do what I can to help you out on it.
Yeah, cool. We'll make it worth your while, Ray, believe me.
Bill, we're running out of time here. I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Yeah, good, thanks.
Good,
it was a real blast. I really enjoyed it. So it's
good luck with the new CD. I wish all good things for you and the band. It's a great CD. Bride of Chaotica's Ghosts on Television. You can get it at CD Baby, and I checked on Amazon. It's there on Amazon. We need to get some good reviews on it. And so what's next for the band? What's you've got a lot of material that you want to put out some more music out.
We're starting on the next album.
Okay.
Yeah, we're starting the first four songs in the next album. It's all going to be in the 80s, there was this like neo-psychedelic kind of revival thing that happened. I mean, a lot of it, you know, was all over the world in different styles, but the late 60s, you know, L.A.-centric version happened in L.A., so we're kind of doing a tribute to them. You know, it doesn't really sound like any of those bands, like Rain Parade or Green on Red or any of those bands, but it's a tribute to those bands, you know? And so that's what the theme is anyway, and so we're trying to record that album. And I don't know, we might get another Christmas EP out again if we get the songs. We have to record those in July, so we'll just have to see. T-Man wants to get a Christmas tree and set it up at the rehearsal studio with a bunch of fake presents and lights and stuff and go and record five more songs for another Christmas EP like Winter Tale. So we might get around to that this year as well, so we'll just have to see how it goes.
All right, well, make sure you book a few gigs here in Sarasota and Bradenton, because it's not far.
Yeah, and Bradenton, see, if Bradenton has a scene now, that's cool, too, because that's imminently doable. We go across the bridge, and we're there, you know, so
exactly.
That's totally happening. Like I say, much better than going up the Mousetown, man, because that's just a killer drive now. It's just ugly, man. It's always just ugly, all capital letters getting there and back, so.
Bill, thanks again, man, for being on the show. All good luck for you, and we'll talk again soon, okay?
Okay, well, thanks so much, Ray. I really appreciate it, and thanks again for having us. Really
thank you. To purchase Bride of Chaotica's exciting new CD entitled Ghosts on Television, visit CD Baby or Amazon.com. For further information and concert date information about Bride of Chaotica, visit their Facebook site at www.facebook.com/Bride of Chaotica Band. You can also find them on Reverb Nation, www.reverbnation.com/Bride of Chaotica. Very special thanks to Doug and Don Newsom with BBS Radio for making it all happen every show. Join me bi-weekly Mondays at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on The Ray Shasho Show. If you have comments or suggestions or would like to be a guest on The Ray Shasho Show, call 941-877-1552 or email us at ray@publicityworksagency.com. And don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of Their Wacky Family Business, or the second edition entitled Wacky Shenanigans on F Street, Proud to be Politically Incorrect in Washington, D.C., available now at Amazon.com. You will live it. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Join Ray Shasho every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on PBS Radio, Station 1.